My name's Matt. I'm the minister at Maybridge. If we haven't met, let me add welcome to you if you're visiting or you're here for the first time. I would ask you to bear with me this morning. I'm not feeling very well. Got a bit of a sort of cold cough thing. Also, on Friday, I had to have a tooth out, which is horrible. I was in a dentist chair for an hour and 45 minutes, and I wanted some public sympathy. So thank you for indulging that. So, I'm not on top form. What I'm going to ask you to do before I say much is just ask, I know it's a really heavy question to begin with. Turn to the person next to you and just answer this question. How many people do you know who you would call true friends? How many people do you know who you would call true friends? If they're a dentist, it doesn't count. They're never anybody's true friend. But how many people do you know who you'd call true friends? Okay, let's regather. So hopefully you could say at least one or two, right? Hopefully many. So we're in week four. We're doing this mini series, as Antoinette said, on love and sex and relationships and God. Week one was sex. Week two was same sex. Week three was gender identity. So we're hitting all of the light topics in this series. Some may have expected that on this fourth and final week we'd end up talking about marriage, but I deliberately didn't want to do that because churches talk about marriage quite a lot these days, I think. Not that it's bad. So I love marriage, I am married, but that's not where we're landing today. You see, if we add up the last 3 weeks, and do listen online if you weren't here, you weren't available, we've said that our culture idolises sex and romance, and those are good things, but they're not meant to be ultimate. And the way that Jesus talks about relationships, sex is reserved for marriage between men and women, and our identity is found best in him. Now, it's hard to go over much more than that right now. As I do say, it's all online if you want to listen back. But because of all that, I want to end this series talking about not marriage, but the opposite, singleness. Now, you may or may not know this, a little fact for you. 40% of adults in the UK are single. And it's rising. In the church, it's a bit lower, but still a lot of people, about a third of adults in the church, are single. So you might be sat here, and as soon as I've said this, you're thinking, well, I'm not single, so this doesn't affect me. Well, you definitely know people who are single, and honouring them and serving them is important. And it's not impossible that at some point you will be single again, right? Because of life. Singleness is in the Bible a fair bit. Most notably, Jesus was single, and we also know that Paul, one of the most influential early church leaders, was single as well, at least at the point in his life when he was travelling and writing. Now, why are people single? Why do screens suddenly go off when I press a button? Might be another question. Why are people single? It may be that they simply enjoy the benefits of being single. They like the autonomy and the freedom. It might be that they feel called or led by God to be single for now or maybe even for life. It might be that they really like to be in a relationship or marriage but haven't happened to meet somebody they want to marry. Or it could be that they're separated, divorced or widowed. I don't know about you, but when I hear the word single, I tend to think of a young adult. But actually, single people are of any age and for different reasons, often sad reasons in later life. Now, we cannot assume with any person that we know why they're single unless they tell us. This means that looking to matchmake or ask questions about when they'll settle down is almost certainly not helpful. There might be deep and even very painful reasons why someone is single, and we should definitely start by saying we're not speaking as if it's some sort of deficiency. It definitely isn't. If we think that being single is second best, we've probably bought into our culture's idea that romance and sex are the pinnacle of life, which they're not. In the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 7, this is in a letter written to the ancient church in Corinth, there's this passage about relationships, and Paul the author speaks about marriage, but you might be surprised to hear he's very positive about singleness. He writes to them, this is chapter 7, "I wish that all of you were as I am," and he's single, he's talking about that, "but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." Now, a few things. First, the person who is single and the person who is married each have a gift. Both of them do. Being married is good and being single is good. They're both good, just in different ways. Secondly, you'll have noticed Paul says staying unmarried is good. Now, that might sound like he's quite negative about marriage, like marriage is a sort of a, it's a last resort for people who are too full of lust, so they better just get married. The thing is, third, the Greek word where it says burn with passion was more about real love and affection than sexual desire. And the backdrop of this passage is that in Roman culture and in Roman thinking, sexual passion was not the main driver why people got married. Most marriages were arranged with an eye on status and money and producing heirs. Often, for men particularly, to find sexual fulfillment, they would find it in slaves and prostitutes. Shocking to us, of course, but that was just the norm in that society. What Paul is actually saying here is, if you are passionately in love with somebody, genuine love, not lust, if you're passionately in love with somebody and it's appropriate for you to marry, by all means get married. That's okay, that's fine, go for it. But let's not lose track of what we're talking about. Singleness is a gift. A gift. Why would that be? Well, he says a little bit later in the chapter, "I'd like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs. How can he please the Lord? But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world. How can he please his wife? And his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world. How can she please her husband?" I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. I love his intention at the beginning of the paragraph. I want you to be free from concern. I wish people wrote me letters that started like that. Anyone who's been married knows marriage does not instantly make life easier. You've got a whole other person and their needs and their opinions to consider 24/7. But Paul is not saying, well, being single is great because you can do whatever you like with no accountability. No, that's not what he's saying. It means you're free to give God undivided devotion. So there's actually a big onus and responsibility on single people to use the gift that they have, the time and the space they have, to serve. Now remember, this is addressed to a church. So if you're single, you're needed. I would say it's no coincidence that looking around the church today, many things in church life depend on a large extent to people who are single. They really do. I see it all of the time. Now we'll come back to this, but while singleness is a gift, it can also bring great challenges. And these are not true for every person who's single, I know, but they are common. And it's good for us to be aware of these because they definitely affect people that we know, even if they don't affect us ourselves. So a few things on the challenges of singleness. And I have to say, this is based on, there's a helpful website called singlefriendlychurch.com. So a lot of this I sort of got from them. One challenge of singleness is the assumptions of others. For example, that you lack something, or that you're being lazy, or that you need some help, you need to be set up with somebody. Not helpful. There's definitely the potential for loneliness or isolation. Not all single people are automatically lonely, but some are. And that's a challenge. In the same way, sometimes married people are lonely. holidays. Whether it's a holiday trip, you know, you're going on, you know, going on 3 weeks overseas or whatever, or it's a few days off, or big celebrations like Christmas or birthdays, there can be a question for single people over who to spend time with. Unless you're massively introverted, you probably do want to be around people for some of these sort of things, and that can be a challenge. Are you included? Are you invited? Are you not? There can be a potential absence of touch. People need physical touch, you know, a hug, an arm around the shoulder. And that might not happen so much if you're single. And one of those things at the right time means an awful lot. There's the danger of becoming set in your ways. Being single, and particularly living alone, I've observed, can lead people to be quite used to getting their own way, which is not, of course, always a good thing. Church can be difficult. Sadly, many single people find that church is a struggle because it can feel like everything is aimed at couples and kids. The largest ever survey of single Christians in the UK, undertaken by Christian Connection, gathered the experience of nearly 3,000 single churchgoers. And the researcher David Pullinger says this: singles often feel isolated and lonely in their churches. They feel invisible and they think about leaving. Couples and families tend to socialise together, and single people often aren't invited until they get a partner, when the invitations miraculously start coming in. Even worse, invitations can instantly dry up if someone becomes widowed or divorced. Isn't that terrible? The time when you probably would most appreciate an invitation. And finally, celibacy. Now, based on the way of seeing sex and relationships we've discussed in the last few weeks, for followers of Jesus, to be single well is also to be celibate. Now, for some, the idea of not being sexually active is incredibly difficult. If sex is for marriage only, then God's call for the unmarried, logically, is to be celibate. And from the point of view of our world, this is probably one of the craziest sounding ideas imaginable, maybe even to some Christians. I'm reminded of the quote from the ancient church leader, St. Augustine, who once said, "Lord, give me chastity and self-control, but not just yet." My friend Anne, who is attracted to other women but has chosen to live celibately, says when she tells people, they're shocked. How on earth can you live like that, they say. You know, you're denying yourself. They'd be fine if she was having sex of any type with any person, but to choose not to have it, well, she must be mad, surely. But for many people, whether same-sex attracted or not, celibacy is God's call and intention. The Catholic author Dan Matson, a celibate Christian, says, "My life isn't a life of misery, and I am not doomed to celibacy or a life of heartbreaking loneliness. I reject the representation of my life as striving for celibacy as miserable. And part of my mission in life is to debunk all the dreary, droopy tropes out there about what celibacy is all about." So what is good about celibacy? Why does God honour and value it? A few things. It reminds us that sex is sacred. Now, we said at the beginning of this series, sex is sacred, that the idea of meaningless sex is naive socially and scientifically, that the research shows that the chemicals released in the brains of men and women when they're sexually intimate have the effect of creating attachment feelings in the brain. The stakes are high when we're sexually intimate. The reality is God intended sex to be sacred, to be special and exclusive. When single followers of Jesus choose to be celibate, they take Jesus seriously and live out his sexual ethic, and it helps form them to be more like him and to demonstrate something to the rest of the world, that sex is not to be treated too lowly like a triviality or too highly as though it's the point of life. Next, celibacy demonstrates that a fulfilled life doesn't necessarily have to involve sex. The narrative of our culture is that it's impossible to live a fulfilled life if you're not getting some. It's a load of nonsense. When single followers of Jesus live celibately, they model the truth that living well, happily and purposefully, is not dependent on sex at all. Celibacy also shows us that healthy intimacy is perfectly possible, even normal, without sex. Another lie of our culture is that sex and intimacy are the same thing, and they're not. But this is why, tragically, some people spend their whole lives focused on sex, because they think it will bring the intimacy they really want. and it doesn't, and then they don't know where to turn. In reality, as we've said previous weeks, nobody needs sex, but everybody does need intimacy. And celibate people help show us that this is true. The trendy American researcher and speaker Brené Brown says this: after studying vulnerability, shame, and authenticity for the past decade, here's what I've learned. A deep sense of love and belonging is an irreducible need of all people. We are biologically, cognitively, physically, and spiritually wired to love, to be loved, to belong. When those needs are not met, we don't function as we're meant to. We break, we fall apart, we ache, we hurt others. We absolutely do, of course, need to be loved, to be close to other people, to be in meaningful, deep relationships. And when that doesn't happen, we're a mess. Society's a mess. But that is not achieved by sex. It's achieved by meaningful relationships, the vast majority of which in life, of course, don't involve sex at all. And in our idolatry of marriage, I think often the church has missed this. David Bennett, who writes about celibacy and singleness, says this: the church needs to return to a view of celibacy as a valid option and a sacred gift in response to Jesus' love. If the church does not recognize and value this truth, the lives of celibate gay Christians, that's the point of view he's writing from, will be indescribably difficult, and the church will remain locked in idolatry. Single people who are faithful to God remind us that the aim for the church is that this is a wider family where there's a social intimacy that we all need. In short, what single people need is what all of us need, and what I think is one of the most undervalued things in our world right now: genuine, meaningful friendship. We all need it. David Bennett again says, I never once heard a sermon about the friendship or singleness of Jesus Christ. Why? I wondered if we were missing the point. Jesus called us to value him above everything else, including our sexual desires and our marriage relationships. Yes, marriage was God ordained, and God had said it was good for man not to be alone. But God, not marriage, was to be our ultimate desire. The overemphasis on marriage made it terribly difficult, as a young gay man wrestling with my sexuality, to flourish in the community of my church. When the focus was on God's kingdom, I could belong. But as soon as romantic relationships were the focus, I felt alienated. I think he's right. I think the church has often overemphasized marriage, important as it is, good thing as it is, and has missed the biblical emphasis on church as a community of friends united by following Jesus. So let me just say to those who are single who are here today, thank you. Thank you for serving us and bearing with us and demonstrating the way of Jesus to us in lots of ways. We need you, and you are certainly part of our family. Please forgive us married people when we forget that or we don't express that well. Now, my hope is, if you've listened up to this point and you're someone who is married, I hope by now you're thinking of the single people that you know and going, oh, you know, they're great. How could I serve them and love them more practically? Well, here are some starters, really practical. I conferred with some single friends on this, all right? So this is not just all my ideas. My single friends helped me with this list of things. So here's how to love and honor single people. Firstly, invite people, not just the ones who are the same as you, into your life in a meaningful way. Have them round for dinner. Take walks together. Hang out with your kids with them. I mean, they might say no, but they'll definitely appreciate the invitation. Remember them on big occasions. You know, birthdays, Christmas. Invite them into these things without pressure. They'd love to be invited, I guarantee you. But also, don't assume that single people want the same life that you have. If you're married, or you know, you're married and you have children, don't assume that your single friends want what you have. They might do, but equally they might not. Show up to celebrate. When your single friend gets a job promotion, or graduates, or they get a new house, all these are moments that you want to share with other people. These are great moments when you can be with your single friends and be enthusiastic and present and celebrate these things. On Sundays, like we are today, make a conscious effort to greet those who arrive on their own. Sit with them. Include them in your chat. Now, to be honest, this is just good to do with anybody. If someone walks in here on a Sunday, you don't know if they're single anyway. So just include people in your chat or with your family. It's definitely easier for you if you're with somebody or with a group to take the initiative than it is for somebody who's on their own to take the initiative with you, isn't it? That's obvious. Be aware of over-focus on family talk. It's really good to share about your kids or your family life, and your single friends probably do care about your marriage and your children, but don't overdo it. I do cringe sometimes when I'm in a group and the people with kids just talk about their kids the entire time. Like, and I've got kids, I know they dominate your life, right? They do. But single people, while they will care about your kids, they don't only want to talk about your kids. So have that bit of self-awareness. Next, be a support in times of sickness. Being sick is horrible, isn't it? But it's especially hard maybe if you live on your own. Can you be the person who, you know, takes someone a meal? Can you be the, you know, someone's quite seriously sick, goes with them to a hospital appointment where, you know, you'd really appreciate having someone alongside you, those sort of health concerns. Can you be a support in times of sickness? Can you try to take note and remember those days that might be painful for your single friends and consider how you could show support on those dates? For example, the wedding anniversary of somebody who is widowed, or Mother's Day coming next week, or Father's Day or Valentine's Day. Could you consider big life plans with your single friends? For example, would you invite them on a family holiday? Does that sound too extreme? I don't think it should. They might not want to come, but they'd appreciate the invitation. We're church family. It should be normal to do even these sort of big things of life together. And finally, ask. Not all single people are the same, so ask them what helps them enjoy community with other people. Just ask. They'll appreciate it. Now, speaking personally about some of these things, Naomi and I try to involve friends who are single in our lives quite a bit, in our house and in our family. And let me be really clear on this. We are not doing our single friends a favour or a concession when we try to include them. We're not doing them a favour. They benefit us far more, actually. In fact, we rely on a number of our single friends. They're role models for our children, and we need them. I hope they get something from us too, but definitely we get the most out of the bargain. Now, on the other side of the coin, how single people can honour God and the church. Now, I was in two minds about saying anything on this, but I shared what I was going to say today with a single friend of mine, and they said, "You're too soft on single people." Thanks, Piero. And they gave me some pointers. So this might sound hollow coming from someone like me who is married, but this isn't really my material, right? So if you're annoyed, he's over there. So, firstly, do life with other singles. Host together, you know, if you even live together. But try not to make your friendship dynamics all about finding a mate or moaning about married people. Focus on serving others and sharing the image of God friendship that you have that all, one day we will all have to come. Next, submit your hopes and desires to God and work to keep him ultimate. It might be tempting, if you're single, to begrudge married people, but ask God to show you the joy and opportunity of being single. Work on your habits and your relationship with God. And if you do end up being married one day, you'll be a better spouse for it, that you've done the prep work. Don't try to compensate for any pain that you may have around being single through over-serving or busyness. I have seen people do this, just try and fill up the diary with serving other people. And no one tells you off for that because it looks really good. But don't overcompensate for any pain by doing this. You'll only burn out and you'll get mad at people who are more, you know, who are less available or flexible at you when the priority is rightly on their marriage at times. Next, learn more about biblical marriage. Let it inspire you by encountering the truth of the image that marriage gives of how much God loves us. We're his church, but he loves each of us personally. And marriage is designed to show that relationship between God and his people. Support your married friends in their marriages. Encourage your married friends. Help them live out this picture of Jesus and his church. And don't be afraid, even if you're single and your friend is married, to give them unsolicited advice about their marriage. Pray for them. House sit, babysit, join them on shopping trips and normal life stuff. You'll soon see marriage is not a walk in the park that sometimes it can appear to be from the outside. And finally, be honest and intentional. Be brave if you're single and ask to be included. Don't wait or expect your married friends to know exactly what you need or you're struggling with. Ask for prayer. Ask to be included. Look to build friendships. So that's some very brief practical stuff. But there's something even more important that you can see when you put marriage and singleness together as separate gifts. They both point us to the future that we have as followers of Jesus. The author Dani Treweek has done loads of research into the nature of singleness, and she puts it like this, really nicely. Earthly marriage and the faithful expression of human sexuality within it points us towards the type of new creation relationship we as the collective church will have with our Saviour. Meanwhile, earthly singleness and the facial expression of human sexuality through celibacy points us towards the type of new creation relationships that we will have with one another. Isn't that beautiful? Literally, everyone has the chance to demonstrate this because everybody is either married or single, right? What does she really mean? Well, the promise of the Bible is that one day, Jesus will finally put everything how it's supposed to be. Heaven and earth will become one place. They won't be marriage between people because what it points to, our union with God, will be realized. All the marriages of now point to it. In the same way, we will have incredible relationships with each other because there won't be sin and insecurity and so on. We'll all get on like a house on fire. And single people are intended to point to that through their relationships today. So single people are part of God's plan, part of his people, bring loads to the church. And for as long as they're single, they're called to be celibate. And alongside married people, between us, we point to the wonderful future reality of life with God. But just to summarize today, singleness is a great calling from God and should be honored. The church in recent times has often done a poor job of valuing singleness and loving single people. There are unique blessings and challenges to both singleness and marriage. Those who are single should see their singleness as a gift and look to use it. Single people are called to live celibately as appointed to God. And single people are vital to church life and should hear this from the rest of us. I hope you've heard it today, if you're single. This church, like all churches, is intended to be a community, a network of overlapping sacrificial friendships. But often we get it wrong. If you've been let down by the people at church, including this church, I'm really sorry, that's not how it's supposed to be. We Christians aren't perfect, but at the same time, remember, part of why church isn't perfect is you. None of us is a perfect friend, unfortunately. We desperately want great friends, I'm sure all of us, great intimacy, and yet nobody in this room is qualified to meet all of anyone else's needs as a friend or anything else. So outside Christian faith, that's all there is, some good advice and a tough reality about the gap between our desires and our regular experiences. If only, in our broken and deeply lonely society, if only there was a greater friend who could be this to us, who could transform our other friendships. Of course, we believe we do have that friend. It's Jesus. And I want to end what I'm saying today and this little series we've done this with this. The night before Jesus was killed, he had a really intense chat with his closest friends. Because he knows what's coming, it's like a deathbed conversation where, you know, you're telling your closest people all your most important thoughts. And here's a bit of that conversation. And remember, Jesus speaks as somebody who was single. And here's what he says. My command is this. Love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. For everything I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Now, whatever your beliefs or opinions or convictions on issues around sex and identity, like we've looked at the last few weeks, Jesus' incredible invitation is that we walk with him as friends. That God himself would step alongside us and say, I call you friends, is the most incredible thing. We're not equal friends, right? Of course, not on the same level. But we're also not merely servants being jobs to do. By calling us friends, Jesus implies he is the friend that we really need. The intimacy, the identity that we really need is to be found through him and him alone and modeled through his people. how good it is that we're not alone in this, eh? And what I hope, what a great note to end this series on. He is the one that we need, not somebody else, not generating some identity or ideas from within ourselves. We need him.